It's hard to imagine now, but the early days of the Ebola epidemic weren't all that long ago, when Ebola cases were counted not in the thousands, but one at a time. Dr. Joshua Mugula was in Liberia's capital when the epidemic began. He's an associate professor of emergency medicine at Indiana University, and he was in Liberia to help develop programs to prepare for various disasters. Mugula's work had nothing to do with Ebola, and yet that is exactly what he found himself suddenly facing. Dr. Mugula spoke with NPR's Rebecca Davis about the day the first Ebola patient appeared at JFK Hospital in Monrovia.
As Dr. Mugula tells it, he arrived for work early one morning at the hospital in Monrovia and was told by an anxious colleague that a very sick man was admitted to the emergency department the night before. At first, the medical staff thought he had malaria, but as the night wore on, they realized he had all the symptoms of Ebola. Dr. Mugula was shocked to discover that 7 hours after the patient arrived, the man still had not been put into isolation. He asked to see the patient.
So we go into the emergency department. The one room he's laid in is a small, crowded room without air conditioning. And there's always a horrible stench going in there just because there's 26 people in a room with very poor ventilation. And so we go in there, and we see, as we walk in, the patient we're talking about is on an iron bed, and he's obviously sick. I mean, you can see it from across the room. He's sweating. He's moaning. He's essentially kind of comatose at this point.
As Dr. Mugula stood there, two other doctors, Abraham Borbor and Samuel Brisbane, joined him. They all realized the moment they'd been dreading had finally arrived.
Everybody was terrified. We had had many conversations in the preceding week about how scared they were and what might happen if an Ebola patient came in. So everybody was realizing that this was finally here. It had happened, and now they were going to have to deal with it.
They tried to recall off the top of their heads what they would need for handling this patient without infecting themselves or anyone else.
We knew we needed to get him into an isolation room. And we're trying to decide if the room had to have a sink or if the room had to have a working toilet, or can you use plumbing with Ebola, or do you have to actually burn the feces, or we were just trying to remember. It's like we couldn't remember what exactly had to be done.
They decided to move him into a small, empty room at the back of the ER. The doctors and nurses started putting on their gloves and masks and gowns. Dr. Mugula says everyone was really nervous, but they were sort of joking around as they gowned up.
So I reached for a pair of gloves and grabbed for a gown, and Dr. Borbor, who's the head of medicine in the emergency department, he laughed at me, and he said, there's no way you're going to be touching this patient. He said, I'm not going to make international news for letting the first white man catch Ebola.
Dr. Mugula pulled back. He didn't want to, but because he was a guest and a visitor to this hospital, he felt like he had to respect Dr. Borbor's wishes. So he turned to help two custodians put their protective gear on. They'd been called in to help move the patient.
These are just two basically, young 20 or teenage boys who worked in the hospital. I doubt they'd ever even put on latex gloves before. So I was trying to demonstrate to them without touching them the process of putting this on and how they wanted to put on two pairs of gloves and, how to tie their masks. And they were very nervous, obviously. They were terrified.
Still, they got to work helping Dr. Borbor move the patient into the isolation room just a few feet away.
But as they do that, they realize when they get to the door, the bed is too wide to actually fit through the door.
And so they ditched the idea of moving the bed and instead picked up the mattress with the patient on it and tried to carry him through the door that way.
There's one person on one side of the bed and two people on the other side of the bed, and so they have a difficult time actually navigating around the iron bed, almost drop the mattress. And so Dr. Brisbane, who's sitting next to me and who hasn't gowned up, he grabs a pair of gloves and puts them on, and he grabs the mattress and kind of holds it up, and they're able to kind of finally navigate the patient on his mattress around the iron bed. And I'm sure he's too heavy at this point, so they kind of set him on the ground still outside the room and end up just manually shoving the mattress in through the doorway and then kind of climbing over it and pulling it the rest of the way into the small isolation room. It's terrifying watching it, but it's also, I can only imagine how terrifying it was being those, not only the two custodians, but Dr. Brisbane, who's now helped transport this patient with no protective equipment on except a pair of gloves. The patient is septic, so he's covered in sweat, and these guys are all now in this hot little room. They're covered in sweat. Dr. Borbor's mask actually slips down over his mouth at one point.
Dr. Mugla reaches over to adjust Dr. Borbor's mask, but he snaps at him and says, have Brisbane do it since he's already touched the patient.
And Dr. Brisbane is trying to, without touching Dr. Borbor, is trying to readjust the mask on his face so that it goes back up over his nose and mouth. And, you know, it's a real mess.
By now, the patient was having a hard time breathing. Dr. Borbor crouched by his head and worked to keep his tongue from closing off his throat.
And at the same time, the two custodians, now essentially that their job of moving the patient is done, start walking out of the isolation room. And I'm yelling at them, stop, you know, don't move, stay in that room, don't come out of that room, don't touch the walls.
He knew the young men could accidentally contaminate themselves or someone else. He ushered them back into the isolation room. But before they remove their gowns, the patient dies. It had been just 40 minutes since Dr. Mugla first learned about the Ebola patient. The custodians and the two doctors removed their gear inside the isolation room.
And they all come out of the room, and they're all, you know, kind of holding their hands so they're not touching anything. And we march them all over to a sink, and, you know, they essentially spend the next, I don't know, 5 or 10 minutes just really, really scrubbing as best they can, you know, washing their hands and rewashing their hands and washing their arms and, you know, splashing water on their face and really trying to decontaminate it as best they can.
Their best, as it turned out, was not good enough. A little over a week later, Dr. Mugla is back in Indiana and he gets a call from an acquaintance in Monrovia.
And he told us that Dr. Brisbane had contracted Ebola. And then I got a call a few days after that saying that he had died and they were going to bury him on his plantation.
And then another phone call. Dr. Borbor had also gotten Ebola and had also died.
Of the people who were there, almost every single one of them contracted Ebola and most of them died.
Three deaths, one survivor, Dr. Mugla, whose life was arguably spared when Dr. Borbor kept him from directly helping with the patient. As for the custodians, those two nervous young men called in to help move the patient, Dr. Mugla says they left the hospital that morning as soon as they could, and no one has seen them since. Dr. Mugla says that as an emergency physician, he's seen a lot of people die, but he feels a particular sadness that comes from losing colleagues who died, he says, just from doing their jobs. Rebecca Davis, NPR News.